Good evening and welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian and Theo. I'm Lauren in Swansea in the United Kingdom, and with me as always is Brian and Theo.
That's right, Brian in Buffalo, New York, US of A, but special guest. Come on, give us your name and where you're from.
Theo, I'm from Swansea.
There you go. Now,
been a few years since he's been on.
It has been a few years. Have you gone through a lot of the ladies? Because last time you were on, you had a lot of ladies.
Yeah.
He's a bit of a cad. He's a heartbreaker.
We're going to start calling you Little Neil Story. The little lady killer.
No, don't do that. Theo has a mullet now, so.
Yeah, that's why we got Theo on for a reason. Because, you know, as we all know, I'm 50 years old, Lauren. I've seen a lot of fashion trends come and go. Some good, yeah. Some not so good. You know, I've seen everything from parachute pants to bell bottoms. But Theo is bringing back the mullet.
He and his friends are the band of mulleteers.
I did not know the mullet was a thing again.
Well,
I'm not sure that it is.
According to Theo and his friends, it is.
But I'm pretty sure Theo is a trendsetter.
He is indeed.
So, Theo, what made you want a mullet? I mean, did you see, like, someone famous with a mullet? Like, were you watching old YouTube clips of, like, Jake the Snake Roberts or Wayne Gretzky?
He's shaking his head no.
No, just, it looks cool.
It looks cool.
But you've seen my hair. Doesn't that look cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, and it's not a mullet.
Yeah, but he's not allowed to have long hair.
Why not?
He did try. I mean, it's taken him a while. It's taking him like 6 months, if not longer, to get a mullet.
The mullet is coming back, folks. Coming soon to a theater near you, the mullet. The mullet is back. Now, you told me he's playing soccer now. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, he is.
Football.
He is. He's very good.
And my question is, isn't football or soccer player hairdos the man bun?
He's not allowed to have long hair. Are you? You're not allowed to have long hair, are you, sweetheart? No, you're shaking his head no.
Who said you can't have long hair?
Who said you can't have long hair, Theo? Who said no to you growing your hair, not having haircuts? It was your mum.
So why'd she do that?
I don't know. I might get him in trouble in school.
Tell you what. My mom overrules your mom, Theo. And my mom says you can have long hair.
Do you think that's true, Theo? He's not in his head. He's going to get himself into trouble.
My mom knows I have long hair.
You going shy? He's not talking now.
No, I know. I almost think I should try my jokes on Theo.
You didn't listen to Brian's jokes.
Does he want to hear my jokes?
Yeah, he asked, are they funny?
Yes. Did you tell him they're hysterical? They're always funny? And you can't get enough of my jokes? Why don't you tell him that, Lauren? Go ahead.
No, I don't lie to my nephew. Burn. Listen to some of Brian's jokes.
Hey,
okay,
Theo.
He wants to listen.
Yeah. All right. Hey, Theo. See, it's audio only, Theo, so you got to respond with words.
He did, but I think he's sitting far away. So you've got to be a bit louder.
Yeah.
All right. Did you know the Invisible Man and the Invisible Woman got married?
No.
Yeah, they did. They're a cute couple, but their kids are nothing to look at.
Did you hear that?
He didn't like it?
No, he's laughing.
Well, it's funny, Lauren, you see?
Apparently I'm a bully. Am I a bully?
We got to talk a little bit about that, Lauren.
Sometimes.
No, I'm not. Sometimes. No, I'm not. How am I a bully?
Well, apparently you're not anymore.
Yeah.
I received an email this week. I love it when people might just tune into like one episode and think they should email us about our banter. Because I got an email from someone saying how disgusting it is that I was so mean to that poor girl and kept calling her a bully while I was being, and here it comes, Lauren, you ready for this? I was being a misogynist and mansplaining my jokes to her.
Well, I think Chris Shelton did roll his eyes a few times at you when he said, okay.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm a mansplainer.
Well, we all know that.
Yeah. Is Theo gone?
Yeah, he's gone to have a cereal. He might be back.
All right, because I have a couple jokes that you might like, Lauren, because they're a little more adult.
Okay, let me just go and close the door right over.
Okay, yes. Close the door. Lauren, we know Lauren likes the dirtier jokes because she's a dirty girl.
Yes, but I also have to protect Theo.
You have to protect him from what? Do you remember my favorite Theo story of all time about him in the street screaming? Do you remember what he was screaming?
Oh, the F word.
The MF words. And he was how old at the time?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. About 6 or 7?
6, maybe. And he's out motherfuckering in the streets. You gotta protect him.
His language is pretty bad.
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of bad language, get this.
Yes.
So, I don't know if it's the same way in Wales as it is in America, but like my phone, my cell phone service, if I'm trying to text someone or message them, I get tons of crazy autocorrects. Does it autocorrect you all the time?
Sometimes.
My favorite example of all time, and this is not a joke, Lauren. My brother was trying to respond to someone in a text, but he was trying to respond with laughter, so he wrote ha 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 and hit send, and it auto-corrected to Haitians. So it made it a very weird conversation. Someone told the joke and he responded with Haitians. So for all our listeners in Haiti, apparently you are auto-corrected. But my phone, every time I try to say the F word, it auto-corrects to duck.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that weird?
Like, a little bit.
It is a little bit weird, but you know, I'm starting to let it go because I figure, hey, at least they're both foul language. No. Come on, that was funny.
No, it wasn't. So, did we get favorable feedback from last week because we kind of didn't have the episode that we said we would?
In other words, you mean we fucked up?
No, we didn't. There wasn't anything to mess up. It was situation happened and it was unforeseen and nobody could do anything about it. So we
improvised. But we left it in the intro that, you know, we were going to be talking about something we weren't. But we made up for it. No, actually, people like the episode. People love Chris Shelton.
Yeah.
We got one listener in particular who just is like the biggest Chris Shelton fanboy now. And he tells me all the time, dude, I don't care what the topic is. I would just listen to Chris Shelton talk about anything. So people love him. And I had a great time. And, you know, Lauren, this week is that promised Planet of the Apes episode.
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm not able to be with you.
Well, she says that because she's afraid we'll fuck up again and it won't be there. And then we're going to sound stupid in the intro again. And she'll say, I didn't sound stupid. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
No.
Well, considering what I've got to have done and being on the podcast, I would choose being on the podcast.
Even if I told more jokes?
Yeah.
That's bad, folks. In case you're all wondering, Lauren's going to a shepherd school. Like, they all have to attend in Wales at least once every 5 years just to keep up their certification.
No, I'm not. No, I'm going as an outpatient to have, I don't even know what you call it, because is it a procedure? Is it like a test? It's a bit of everything, really, because it's invasive.
It's a test, it's a procedure, and it's one of the greatest rock bands of all time.
Spinal Tap.
That's right. Lauren is going to the land of David St. Hubbins, Nigel Tufnell, and she's getting a spinal tap.
Oh, I'm not looking forward to it.
No, but you know I'm going to be sending you spinal tap clips on your phone.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be looking at my phone tomorrow after I've had it done. I don't. It's a weird one.
It is a weird one. Like I said last week, it's an excuse to have something long and hard shoved in your backside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just.
We got a few people mailing in about that, saying that, Lauren, you're going to be great. Everything's going to be fine. We had one woman wrote in that said she had one a couple of years ago, and she was so nervous and so scared, and it wasn't nearly as bad as she thought. So hang in there. And she actually did say her name is Emily. So say thank you to Emily first off.
Oh, thank you so much, Emily. Everybody's been great. I mean, everybody has said it's scary, you know, the paperwork that they send you from the hospital is scary, but that's always scary because they always tell you everything that can go wrong, and you know, the majority of the time it doesn't. It's just it's just another test to wait on.
Yeah, well, Emily also said, don't worry, Lauren, it can't be nearly as bad as Brian's jokes.
We'll see tomorrow. I'll have a review then next time we speak, Emily, and I, you know, what was worse, the jokes or the lumbar puncture. But I mean it's gonna be fine. It's just scary, you know, the fact that you've got to be there and you know, there's, you've got to lie flat on your back for an hour and they're gonna, oh, it'll be okay. Yeah.
You know, I had to go to the doctor this weekend.
Gosh, here we go.
Did you know I've been telling you about all those like really irregular bowel movements I've been having, Lauren?
No.
Yeah, I had to go to the doctor and they diagnosed me with all kinds of weird shit. I'm chortling, Lauren.
I know you're snorting.
Oh, I love that joke. Oh. So, Sarah actually did have a doctor's thing this weekend.
Oh, dear, so, is she all right?
Oh, yeah, she's fine. It's something she has done every, you know, the ongoing procedure she has done every few months. But she's fine. But except for the fact that she's here looking at me with, like, just daggers in her eyes at these jokes.
So, plus, did we get any more?
Every morning, Every morning I wake her up and tell her, you know what, I think I'm going jogging. It's kind of a running joke.
You can wallop you if you're not careful.
What?
She's going to wallop you.
Probably. She probably will, but that's okay. Anyway, other than, you know, Spinal Taps and all kinds of weird shit, what else is going on?
Not much. Just all that at the moment.
I mean, I understand Spinal Tap's kind of a big deal that, you know, not much. Whoa. Billy just did a backflip.
Like a real one.
Yeah. Like, I think he was trying to, like, catch a piece of, like, see, he's got these, like, on a wand, like these, like, feathers that you move around on a wand, and he plays with them and bats them and chases them.
Yeah.
And I think one of the feathers came out of the thing and was floating in the air, and he was trying to jump at it.
Aw.
Did a
backflip. He's a gymnast.
He is. He's a weird one. But that's Billy. So I was distracted by my cat. Sorry, folks. That's nothing to do with the show, but I guess now you have more inside information.
Yes.
Speaking of inside information, Lauren, I heard you're having a procedure tomorrow. I have to make fun of it, you know.
Yeah. Until it goes wrong and I'm not here anymore and you'll be crying.
The only thing that's going to go wrong is you're going to be on that table and they're going to start the procedure and then all of a sudden there's going to be... Oh, Lauren, stop it. Right in the doctor's face.
Oh, gosh, don't. No. I'm just terrified.
Of farting at the doctor?
I'm terrified. No, I'm terrified that they won't be able to do it, and then I'll have to go back, and they'll have to do a guided one with x-ray and everything. It's just all the fuss. I want it over and done with now.
Yeah, they'll be able to do it.
I hope so. And then,
but just don't toot in the doctor's face.
I won't. I promise.
Do you say toot over in the UK?
Not really.
No? Just fart?
Mm.
Poot? What do you what's a slang term for a fart over there?
I don't know, beef? Really.
Like someone beefed? I never understood that one. That was big when I was in school. Someone beef? Never understood it. You have no slang terms for farts.
I think Trump.
Well, that's a good one here now.
Yeah, but I didn't like to bring that one up.
Yeah, but you don't say toot or I don't know. Eggy stinker.
Yeah. No, you've definitely got these on your mind.
How about the ones where, like, your butt cheeks clap after you do it? Like, I'm sorry. There's an old expression. Farts are funny.
Oh.
We can stop talking about farts if you want now.
Yes, please.
Okay. That's fine. I don't know what else there's to talk about. Sure, there's a lot to talk about. I'm excited. We're going to be doing the Planet of the Apes show tonight, which those who listened last week found out it's my favorite sci-fi film series of all time.
Mine was Star Trek.
Yours is Star Trek. Chris's was Star Trek. I like the one with the whales, Lauren.
The Voyage Home. That was good.
Yeah, that's a good one. Actually, I like a lot of the Star Trek films, but I love the Planet of the Apes films, and I love Star Wars. I love science fiction. I love Blade Runner. You know that.
I do.
I like horror movies more than science fiction, as a rule, but I'm so excited to be talking apes today. And, oh, Cleo's on the computer. Hi, Cleo.
Hello, Cleo. Poor girl.
Nope, she just walked away like, yeah, I'm done. I just wanted to, like, interrupt your computer.
Yeah.
That's how she rolls. Yeah. That's Cleo. anyway, thank you, Cleo.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for your presence, Cleo.
Yeah, so we talked about your Spinal Tap.
Yes, I know it's annoying. I know it's annoying because I keep going on about it, but I can't think of anything else at the moment. So I am deeply sorry, and I hope that will...
Ooh, you just heard Oliver Onions. That's my cell phone ringing, but I forgot to turn it off.
Ooh, is it important?
No, it was an unknown caller, which means it was probably a telemarketing scam.
We would like to... We have been trying to reach you about your car's extended warranty.
I love that one. Because I don't have a car.
I like it now when people are decorating, and before they put the wallpaper on, they put, we've been trying to reach you about your car's extended warranty.
We have been getting weird ones in America lately. That, like, the phone will ring, and it'll actually have a phone number on it. It's not even, like, block number, unknown caller. It'll actually have, like, a phone number, like it's legitimate. And you answer it, and it's someone speaking Chinese.
Is that you, though?
No, everybody I know has been getting them. You're not getting them in the UK yet?
No.
It's bizarre because, you know, they're using spoofed phone numbers now. But the fact that you answer and it's already... You know, a voice, and I don't want to do the Chinese language because I don't know it and it'll sound insulting. But you know what I mean.
We get AI ones, like with a recorded voice, and then, you know, but they are generated numbers, and they're generated so they're not call center numbers. Like, they've got a local area code. They're not the normal standard phone numbers for a call center.
Speaking of AI, and this is, sometimes I'm half asleep when I'm reading articles, and it's all these articles bashing AI, and because I'm half asleep, I keep thinking, what's wrong with A1 steak sauce? I like A1 steak sauce. That never happened to you?
No.
I'm going to tell you a true story, Lauren. This happened many moons ago, back when I was a drinker. I came home from the bar probably about 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, because that's how it was back in those days. I got into my apartment and I couldn't sleep, so I put on the TV. And back, this was probably in the 90s, you know, they used to have a guide on the TV that you'd put on a station and it would show you what's on every channel. I don't know if they still have that, but they did then. And I saw something. I said, oh, that'll be great to watch while I'm drunk and happy. And I turned it on and I watched for a solid half hour, laughing my ass off, thinking I was watching Benny Hill, but I was actually watching Benny Hinn, the televangelist. But it was so weird. I thought it was a Benny Hill sketch. Until I realized there were no boobs anywhere.
Either Benny Hill broke out into evangelical comedy.
I thought it was like, you know, sometimes his sketches would run long. And I thought it was just like one long sketch. And then I realized there were no boobs. So this probably, and then it was Benny Hill. Oh, Holy Ghost, Holy Ghost, Holy Ghost, Holy Ghost. But I was in hysterics for about a half hour thinking that fucking Benny Hill is so brilliant.
We do have other words in Christianity other than Holy Ghost.
Holy Ghost. Holy, not Benny Hinn, he doesn't. You ever see Benny Hinn, the televangelist?
No.
Oh, God. Look him up sometime, Lauren. It's, you know, the very famous stereotype of American televangelists?
Yeah.
Oh, Benny Hinn's like the epitome of that.
There's one I have a bit of a weird relationship with, because I don't know her, Is it Ruth Meyer?
Mm-hmm.
I get what she's saying, but then I don't get that she's saying it dressed head to toe in designer gear, dripping with jewelry.
Well, Kenneth Copeland tells us that he needs several luxury private jets because God wants him to look fancy.
No, so God doesn't want you.
So keep giving me millions of dollars so I can have more private jets. He actually says this to his congregations, and he gets millions and millions of dollars a month.
But if God wanted you to look fancy, then why was Jesus a carpenter? Why was Jesus humble? Jesus was sent to serve. I mean, Jesus didn't have millions. He relied on the hospitality of others. Yeah.
Do you really think a carpenter at that time was that humble a profession? I'm pretty sure people needed carpenters. He was probably busy.
Yeah, but then you think about the problem you have as a tradesman today. You have people refusing to pay you, to getting in disputes with you over, you know, stupid things. I mean, he wasn't living in a mansion.
No, but I also believe that's a fuck-up translation. He wasn't a carpenter. I think he was a cobbler, because he spent a lot of time with toes. Wasn't he all about washing feet? Jesus had a foot fetish.
No, he didn't. It's about him asserting the fact that he's there to serve, and that he, you know, and that he's not there to be front and center. He, you know, whoever is, you know, who it is all about, he is there to serve. He's not there, you know, to be a king or a politician. He is there to serve us.
There are ways to do that without touching toes.
Well, I mean, if you think about the context of it, they would wear sandals and they would be in the dusty desert.
You know what we call those in America?
What?
Well, we don't. I do. Some people I know do. We call them Jerusalem jumpers. You want a pair of Jerusalem jumpers?
So, you know.
You know, our favorite listener, the priest, is not going to be happy with me right now.
No, I wouldn't say. I also wouldn't bring Jerusalem into a conversation during this point of time. That's very...
Well, it's because of the shoes.
Yeah, but there is a reason why he is washing feet. That is contextually correct and would have imparted the lesson.
There's more than one reason.
I'm
just saying.
And it was trying to impart the lesson that he was... trying to teach. Which,
why couldn't you scratch their back then? Got a little itch, I'll scratch that right there without touching toes.
But
I just have an aversion to feet.
I know, but you know, it would have been a practical thing for him to have done in his own time. Like, if he came back in COVID, he'd have washed everybody's hands.
Okay, see, I could dig that. Because if you're wearing them sandals, you probably got some bunions, and you probably got some corns on your feet.
I think you're overthinking this.
I think I'm really overthinking this. I think we better.
I think that you need to go back to Sunday school.
Is that where they make ice cream?
No. You are going to get yourself into trouble.
I know. Oh, you know what? Before I get myself in trouble, why don't you clear your throat and give me a good day in history?
Okay.
Good day in history.
That was a good one. I liked that one, Lauren. That was a real good one. What you got for a day? If your day is a good one.
So my day is the 5th of February, 1649. Prince of Wales proclaimed King Charles II of Great Britain by the convenient Parliament of Scotland. So that sort of begins when we become Great Britain. And it starts the unification process.
And now in 2023, King Charles III came king, who was the Prince of Wales.
Yeah. But that's normally what happens. The eldest child of the monarch, who is Prince of Wales, becomes the king. But he was made King of Britain, which is different because previous kings to him would have been kings of England. There would have been a separate king of Scotland. Wales would have been a principality governed by landowners and the Prince of Wales, and ultimately would be under the rule of the monarch. So it's really a step forward to us being a unificated Ireland.
Do you think he ever let people call him King Chuck?
No, I do not.
Do you think this king does?
No, I do not. And also, I don't know if it's reached America yet or it's been on American news. Unfortunately, during the recent hospital stay, it was discovered that he indeed had cancer or has cancer.
Ooh, I did not hear that.
Yeah, he started treatment very quickly, but he went in for one issue and then this was discovered while they were dealing with it. It was a separate issue from what he went in for, but it was discovered that he does indeed have cancer.
Hey, cancer sucks. And, we do a lot of joking around on this show, and this is not trying to be funny at all. Like, wishing the king speedy recovery, because that's shitty to have happen.
It's, you know, rich or poor, cancer, it doesn't really care.
Cancer's a dick.
Yeah, it really is. It is.
It is.
It's a weird illness.
So you want to hear my day in history, since it has nothing to do with cancer, so it might, like, alleviate some of this gloom.
Yeah, raise the tone.
I chose this day in history, Lauren, because this kind of shocked me that today in history, the 5th of February, 1846, was the first publication of the very first newspaper on the West Coast of the United States. Now, this shocks me for a couple reasons. One, it wasn't until 1846 that there was a newspaper on the West Coast of the United States. That seems awfully late in history, doesn't it?
It does.
And here's the shocking thing. You think West Coast of the United States, you're going to think Los Angeles, San Francisco, one of the big cities. First West Coast newspaper in the United States, which began publishing today in history in 1846, was the Oregon Spectator. How about the Oregon? Not even California.
Well, but it's a good place. Also a good video game, the Oregon Trail.
If you don't get dysentery. Which you always do.
Yeah. Sometimes you get better, though.
Have you ever gotten better?
No, but apparently you...
See?
There was... Apparently, you could get better.
I've never met anybody who did. Everybody I've ever known that's played Oregon Trail either died of dysentery or what was the other one?
Starvation was one of them.
Starvation was one of them. Tainted meat was one of them.
Drowning. You could drown. Drowning.
Yeah, a lot of people drown, which is funny because it's just, why didn't they swim?
But the thing is, as well, is it just, you would just be going along, playing, then all of a sudden the screen would come up, you have died of dysentery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you didn't do anything, you were just plodding away, pressing the buttons, doing what it told you to do, and then all of a sudden you're just like, nah, you've played this enough now, you've died of dysentery.
Well, speaking of dysentery and getting weird diseases, I'm a little nervous about one thing. And before we go on to our interview, I got to ask you, because Sarah told me not to worry about it. Because, you know me, I'm kind of a hypochondriac.
Uh-huh.
But this weekend, I accidentally drank food coloring. Yeah, like the whole bottle. And Sarah says, you know, that I'll be fine. It's okay. I don't need to go to the hospital. But I don't know. I don't know. I feel like I've died a little inside. No? Not a good one at all?
No, please just get to the interview now.
All right. Well, let me fire up the magic interview box.
It's the magic interview box.
All right. And we're going to come back. We're going to be talking apes, apes, all about apes. The 1968 Planet of the Apes, the film series that inspired the two television series and books and comic books and everything else, Lauren. And I'm so excited that my hands are shaking so much I can't even flip the switch. So why don't you flip the switch? Okay, folks, 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 you are going to love this, even though Lauren's not here because, as you know, right now, she's probably lying on a table getting something long and hard stuffed in her backside. So we wish her all the best. Lord, we love you. Wish you were here, but you're not. So I'm going to have fun with this anyway, because I am going to nerd out today, folks. Because we are going to be talking about one of my favorite things in pop culture history. Planet of the Apes. Now, I am an apes freak from my childhood, and I found someone who might be a bigger ape freak than me, because this man has, in my opinion, the greatest website on the entire internet. Yes, I mean even those kinds. the Planet of the Apes archives, run, founded, and just brilliantly put together by Mr. Hunter Goatley. And I got to be careful saying that because I keep mispronouncing his name because I'm, you know, stupid. But Hunter Goatley, not Groatley, is with us. So, Hunter, welcome to the show. And
thank you.
Get ready to nerd out, because we're going to totally nerd out today. How are you?
All right. That's some high praise if my site is above all those others you were referring to.
Yeah, it's better than Only Apes. Before we get going, I'm going to be really nerdy here, and I'm going to say your real name isn't Hunter. You changed it to be like Kim Hunter. Of course, who was Zira? Am I correct?
Sure, if you want to go with that, sure.
I'm going with it.
No, actually, that is my real name, which a little bit of a side story here. This is not the first time people have accused me of making it up or not being my real name. Years ago, in the early 90s, before most people were even on the internet, I started mailing lists for Alice Cooper and Kiss. And people had a hard time believing that Hunter Goatley was really my name. And in the Alice Cooper world, they started to believe that Hunter Goatley was a pseudonym used by Alice Cooper. That he'd made up this name so that he could, you know, post on this mailing list and be anonymous. And the first time I met Alice, when I told him who I was, he said, "Well, it is finally, I'm glad to finally meet you so that people can see that we're two different people."
So he knew all about you being accused.
He knew all about it. He'd had radio DJs ask him, you know, "Is Hunter Goatley a pseudonym of yours?" And
that is so awesome. And I'm a big Alice fan, too.
So, oh, of course.
Going way, way back. Wow, we could do a whole nother show on that. In fact, you probably know Alice. Let's get him on the horn. We'll get him on the show.
I wish I could do that, but I have met him many times. And
tell him we'll take him golfing.
There you go. That would
great
get him.
Golf course, not too far from me. It's pretty, you know, pretty fancy.
Yeah.
Take him to see it, you know. But we're not here to talk about Alice. Although I usually will talk about anything. But we're here to talk about what I like to call the other science fiction franchise. Everybody always says, "Oh, science fiction franchises, that's easy. It's Star Wars and Star Trek."
Right.
And I'm like, no. The first to the big screen was my favorite. And I from when I was a child, my favorite's been Planet of the Apes.
Sure.
What about you? Were you an apes fan before the other ones, or did you come to it later in life, or were you like me running around your neighborhood as a little kid pretending to be a chimpanzee?
Pretending to be a chimpanzee. Fourth Hell grade, yeah. Running around the playground. My friend Kurt and I were doing the chimp muzzle twitches and
yeah, I don't know, in the faces.
The Ronnie McDowell twitching that sold the makeup. I discovered the first time I was exposed to Planet of the Apes was when I saw Conquest of the Planet of the Apes at the drive-in. Not sure exactly when that was, but I assume it was 73 or early 74. I would have been 9 or almost 10, maybe 10 when that happened. And it blew me away. And then subsequently saw the movies when they aired on CBS or around that same time. I don't really remember exactly which was first. I know Conquest was first. I know I saw the movies on TV. I believe it was all around the same time. But I was a huge fan and primed by the time the TV series started in 74.
You see, you got a few years on me. 74 was my year of birth.
Ah.
And the first movie I saw in the theater, believe it or not, was Star Wars, which is always fun to say when people say, what's the first movie you saw in the theater? And no one has anything cool to say. And I'm like, yeah, first film I saw in the theater was Star Wars. Of course, the second movie was Hot Lead and Cold Feet, the Disney movie. So, yeah. You know, you can't have it all cool. But I think I saw Star Wars first. I'm sure I did. Because I was, you know, I have an older brother, five years older. That's why I was dragged to the theater, too, as a little kid to see Star Wars. But I fell in love with apes. Had to be late 70s. And I believe it was through the TV series that I had first seen. Reruns of the TV series on a UHF station in town was replaying it. But when it was cut into films, when they would take two episodes of the TV series and splice them together in a film, and like you'd get Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of the Planet of the Apes, which is like, wait a second, that's not really one of the movies. But that was my first exposure. And I was a kid, like you were a kid when you first saw it. So to me, it was, oh, this is so cool. Talking monkeys, talking apes.
Yeah.
And I was hooked. I didn't care about anything behind it. And then when I was probably in my early teens, and I'd actually watched the original 68 Charlton Heston version of Planet of the Apes, with a semi-adult mind and realized the themes behind it, I became even more obsessed with it as a series.
Yeah.
Now, did you were 9 or 10, but were you able to pick up on the deeper meanings of it at that time? Or was it, you're like me, those monkeys are talking?
Well, the talking apes was certainly what got my attention. I have a pretty good memory for a lot of stuff when I was a kid around that age. But that particular thing, I don't really know exactly when I picked up on the societal aspects of what Planet of the Apes was saying. But I did get into, you know, it wasn't just the talking apes. The whole story intrigued me. The whole, you know, I, like most people when they first saw it, before they had the ending ruined for them, you know, I thought they were on another planet. And so that ending was a real shocker.
Oh, you know, great. Now I'm going to have to put a spoiler alert for a film from 1968. All right, way to go.
I hate talking about that, but there you go.
Yeah, and also thanks for saving my ass for all those simians listening, because it was insulting for me to call them monkeys. They're not monkeys. They're apes.
I started to correct you and decided not to, but thank you.
Well, you did. You corrected me.
That's always been a pet peeve of mine.
Well, yeah. To me, it's always just every time I say it, I think to myself of the scene from Escape from the Planet of the Apes. You better, you know, you want to don't let that monkey go hungry.
Yeah.
And watching Roddy McDowell lose his shit.
Yeah.
Although I'll tell you, and you know, huge Cornelius fan, obviously, as a kid, because he's your star monkey.
Oh, Ape. Sure. Yes.
But I remember also my other passion at that age was Batman. And the moment I realized Cornelius was Bookworm really fucked with my head.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I didn't like Cornelius's voice coming out of Bookworm. That freaked me out.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing I knew about that. I watched Batman in reruns as a kid. I don't remember the moment that I realized, you know, same actor doing both roles. I just kind of feel like I always knew that, so it never really bothered me.
No, Mr. Smarty Pants, I always knew it.
I did like it though. I mean, I've been a huge Roddy fan ever since the first time I saw him back in Conquest. So,
where he is not Cornelius, and we'll get into that.
Right.
But I'm assuming a lot of the people listening to the show are tuning in because they're Planet of the Apes fans or friends of yours. You know, it's one or the other. But for my regular audience, my regular listeners who will listen to any show for some reason, I don't know. I love you all, but I don't understand you. Who might not be as familiar with Planet of the Apes. Let's kind of break down the origins of the species, so to speak. How long into your fandom did you go back and actually read the Pierre Boulle novel?
I was probably 13 or 14 when I read the novel.
The same for me.
I was about 12 when I read my first adult novel. Before that, and not that kind of adult novel.
I was going to say, Lady Chatterley's Lover.
Like most boys in the 70s, I grew up reading the Hardy Boys. And once I read all those, I moved on to the Three Investigators, which were even better. And
there's Hardy Boys plus one.
Yeah. But it was Salem's Lot by Stephen King was the first adult book that I read that I bought off the bookstand, read it, loved it. And then I started branching out. And at some point around that time, I was going to the one used bookstore we had in town. And I found a copy of Boulle's novel and bought it and read it. So I was around 14 or so, probably.
No.
And I was really disappointed because it was nothing like the movie.
See, and I was the opposite. What inspired me to go read the novel was, like I said, when I was probably 12 or 13 and finally watched the original movie with an adult eyes. Really an adult, but you know what I mean? Right. Where I understood what was going on. That made me go, I got to go read this book that it's based on.
Yeah.
And I was not disappointed by it. I loved that it was so different because I said, ooh, yeah, that name Rod Serling in the beginning really did change this. And yeah. it made me love the movie even more, like, ooh, now it's this book plus The Twilight Zone.
Right. Yeah. I did not dislike the book. I just was disappointed when I first read it that I was expecting the movie, you know, told in novel form. It was so very different from the movie that it was a completely different experience. Just as good, but completely different.
It's the first book I also read in French.
Oh, really?
Not at that time. I mean, not till years later.
Right.
And I shouldn't say it's the first book I ever read in French. It's the only book I've ever read completely in French. Because I wanted to. I learned French, passable French. You know, they still yelled at me in France like I was a stupid American because they're French.
Of course.
Sorry. I know people in France listen to us. It's not all of you. It's just you Parisian bastards. When I decided I wanted to try to read a book in French just to get better with the language, that's the novel I chose. And a lot of people will say it's so much better in its native tongue and you don't get the artistry of it unless it's in its native tongue. It's bullshit. It's the same.
Yeah. I can believe that.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people, I think, will be shocked, not apes fans per se, but our audience that it was based on a novel, first off, like we've already established, but it was based on the novel by the same guy who wrote the novel Bridge Over River Kwai, which was turned into the movie Bridge on the River Kwai with Alec Guinness, one of the David Lean film, one of the great films ever made. What do you know about Pierre Boulle other than those two books? Do you know much about him?
Not really. And that's even after I've read articles about him and stuff, but it never seems to stick. So I don't really know much about him.
He's probably one of them snooty frog Frenchies, one of those Parisians. I know that he thought Apes was one of his lesser works and he wasn't like that proud of it, but probably made him more money than anything.
Yeah, probably so. At least I would hope so.
Unless he sold the rights real early, really cheap.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I'm just trying to remember if I remember reading that, but I don't know what the specifics of that were.
It's so weird to watch or read Bridge on or Over River Kwai, whichever version we're talking about, and then Planet of the Apes. They're so drastically different. You would swear they were written by different people. I mean, it's amazing. But the novel, the rights to the novel get sold because somewhere someone said this is going to make an amazing movie.
That would be Arthur P. Jacobs.
Arthur P. Jacobs, most famous at that time for
Dr. Doolittle.
Exactly. I love the story that people weren't taking him seriously with, yeah. You want to do a movie about talking apes? Didn't you just do Dr. Doolittle?
Right.
Different theme, folks. Different.
Yeah.
Jacobs was a visionary. He saw the potential in this, wherein I don't think a lot of people did. Why? I mean, spoiler alert, folks. The reason the novel is so much different than... First off, go and read the novel. All my listeners, I know you're literate because it's a history show. So you should all go read the novel. It's very different. The apes are very technologically sound. It's very modern.
Yeah, they have cars and planes and sort it's like very cartoon. Much... Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the cartoon was closer to the novel than anything.
It was. We're going to get into that in a little bit, too, because there's something that in my craw about that cartoon. But but they decide to make the movie out of this. No one really wants to do it. How did Jacobs go along getting it greenlit? I mean, he was a wonder boy, but still no one wanted it.
Well, the first thing... I'm not sure if this is the first thing, but he infamously got together enough money to create a test film starring Edward G. Robinson as Zaius and James Brolin played Cornelius. And I guess Charlton Heston was in that as Taylor. Heston was it was a very different Taylor. But it was a lot more cerebral. It had nothing really to do with the final movie, the short plot of this thing. But it was done to try to show that with John Chambers' makeup, apes could talk and people could take it seriously. And once he made that, people saw that, oh, this is going to work. And that's how Fox decided to produce the movie.
Or which is amazing because that makeup is so basic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing like the finished product.
No.
Not and even yet close. It still convinced them.
Yeah. Which says a lot for the I think the concept. And as basic as the makeup was, it successfully conveyed that this is going to work.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's not funny, really. It's kind of annoying when I hear people criticize the original films now. Oh, the makeup is so stupid and rubbery looking. It just, I'm like, you know, to me, it still looks pretty damn good.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
I mean, yeah, the CGI apes, ooh, it's great. It's CGI. They look just like real apes. I'm like, they're not supposed to be real apes. They're right. More evolved.
Yes.
So I guess to me, you know, the original's better.
Definitely.
So the original's great because you get Charlton Heston on board, who said, "You can take this script from my cold, dead hands. I believe in this project."
Which was also key to getting it done.
It's his support. When you get Moses on board, you know, it's a good sign.
Right.
He had a good track record at the time.
Yeah.
So he really believed in the project. From what stage do you think? Was the script that Serling helped write and some of the other writers, was that the one he had, or was Heston still sold based on the book?
I think it was the book and the short film they were able to do. As far as I know, that was all before Serling had ever written his script.
Yeah, Heston agreeing. Yeah, that's another thing I think a lot of people listening right now don't realize how big a star Charlton Heston was then.
Oh, yeah.
He was huge. How little people thought of science fiction back then.
Yeah.
You know, this science
fiction was kid stuff.
Yeah. It was drive-in theater fodder. With the exception of very few, maybe The Day the Earth Stood Still, which was respected. Maybe Forbidden Planet, but the rest of it was a joke media. It was a B film media. Now right. You've got a major Hollywood producer, one of the biggest actors in the world behind this project, but you still got to convince a big studio to give you enough of a budget to make one of them films for kids that they show at drive-ins.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine sitting in on some of those meetings?
No, I can't. I'm sure it was quite stressful for them.
Yeah, for all you kids out there, this is before Star Wars. This is before 2001. You know, this is science fiction was still a joke medium to the Hollywood. But
this had so many things that could have derailed it with the fact that it was travel in space. You know, forget the talking apes, just the whole travel in space, the whole time travel aspect of it, all of that were all things that were not popular at the time and could have easily killed the project.
Yeah, it's a pulp novel. Yeah. I mean, essentially, that's kind of what it is. Now, the Pierre Boulle novel isn't. It is more intelligent than a standard science fiction pulp novel.
Yeah.
But the concepts that this film had in it to Hollywood at the time were garbage.
Yeah.
It was B flicks for drive-ins, you know, kiddie films. We'll put a robot in there and the kids will go ooh and ah, and you know, we'll make a dime on it and move on.
Yeah.
This was a far more serious and ambitious project.
Yeah.
Do you remember what the original cost was for the film?
Sorry, no, I don't.
No, I don't either, but it was relatively big budget for the time, not overly budgeted. It's not like one of the $100 million blockbusters today.
Yeah, no.
It was a sizable budget, but nothing outrageous.
A million, 2 million, something like that, I think.
Yeah, and they had to, like, it was budgeted enough to make the film, but I think it was low budget enough where they had to cut corners everywhere, which explains. I wish people could see the lovely background you have because you have Ape City as your background. Ape City, one of the most iconic images in film, one of the greatest sets ever built, was done out of necessity because the budget was so low.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it made the movie better for it.
Yeah.
The original script was more like the Boulle novel, and they had modern technology and cars and planes, and they couldn't afford all that. They couldn't afford to film it. So it got scaled back to this more primitive style, which I think works so much better, at least for that movie and the way it was told. It works so much better.
It really does, because you get the impression, at least I always did. Well, not always, because between the ages of 8 and 11, talking monkeys. But as soon as I was old enough to understand, I always got the impression that they're evolved apes. They've moved on. They've surpassed humans, but they're still not at the level humans were at yet.
Right.
So you could see that technology was getting better. They were practicing surgery because they were trying to perfect it. You know, it's almost like
right.
You're at that mid-range and that whole Ape City and Adobes and the horse and buggies, and it just fits so perfectly.
It does. I think it really helps sell the movie more, sell the belief that you're on a different planet. If he'd gotten there and they had cars that were exactly the same, you can forget the whole English speaking thing, because that's a given for for being a movie. But it was like, I mean, it was hard to put into words what I'm trying to say. They were not primitive apes, but they were not super evolved, which helped sell that. We're in a weird place. This is not like Earth, because it's very different, not just because of the apes, but all this, the houses and everything were so primitive, so different from what Taylor had left.
And now we have to give the warning for all of you people out there who've never seen the movie, all two of you, the ending and the big reveal of the first film, which I know it, I've seen it 100 times, probably more, and it still gives me goosebumps.
Sure.
Especially when you're really into the film again. Like if you're watching it not distracted and you really sucked yourself into the film again, that ending still hits you.
Yeah.
And, I'm a film nerd. I can discuss film going back from 1890s to, the 1970s. After then, film died. But
yeah. I largely agree with that.
Yeah. But I can't think of many films, if any, especially American films, that had such a bleak, dark ending.
Yeah.
I mean, can you, even imagine?
No.
And how that must have just fucked with the heads of people in that audience, because like we said, no American film was... Look, films had happy endings then.
Yeah, right.
And the ending of the film wasn't, we blew up your planet. But can you imagine, I know you're a little too young for it, but can you imagine sitting in that theater watching this quote-unquote science fiction film for kiddies and seeing that ending for the first time?
I can't. The thing, too, is it's not just we blew up your planet or you blew up your planet, but it's not just his realization that that's where he is, but he's stuck there, too.
Yeah.
He's got nowhere to go. This is it.
Yeah.
And that is an incredibly bleak ending and leaves you sucker punched as a viewer.
And it's you destroyed civilization, you destroyed your planet, and you took the biggest city in the world and turned it into this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the symbolism of the Statue of Liberty. Obviously such an iconic symbol, but the fact that that's the biggest city in the world.
Right.
Sorry, Hong Kong. But
that yeah, you've been New York. In
the biggest city in the world this whole time. Happened.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that someone had the balls, because many people today would not have the balls to do that kind of a movie. You know,
oh, yeah.
Harsh ending, slap your audience in the face, have them leave the theaters depressed, which is, it's art. I don't care what it is. It's not just science fiction in a fun film that, or escapism. That's art. Do you think anybody involved with that project ever envisioned there'd be a sequel, let alone a series, to this film?
No, I don't think so. Because what could you do? Established he's there alone. And where are you going to go from there? But of course, that speaks to the brilliance of Paul Dane, that he came up with an idea, and a batshit crazy idea too, for Beneath.
We're going to get into that because Apes, the original Planet of the Apes, is such a monster hit. I mean, it's a monster hit.
Yeah.
To the fact where they gave a special Academy Award for the makeup.
Right.
There was no category for makeup and special effects, but it was so fucking good. Even the Academy, which is usually just up their own ass, but even they looked at that and said, oh, fuck, we got to give them something because that's never been done before.
Yeah.
You know when the makeup started in the Academy Awards, don't you?
I mean, when the awards with Rick Baker.
Yeah, 1981 with Rick Baker.
American Werewolf in London.
And the only reason, because after the Elephant Man, they said, fuck, how can we not give an award for that makeup? Well, right. Let's invent an award. And the next year, Rick Baker won it, American Werewolf in London.
And was presented to him by Kim Hunter.
It was in Vincent Price.
And Vincent Price, yeah.
I actually have on my wall behind me. You see, my whole apartment is all autographed stuff.
I did see that.
Yeah, right up there is a picture of Rick Baker, signed by Rick Baker, of him getting the award from Kim Hunter and Vincent Price.
Awesome. Love that photo.
Yeah. That's up there signed by Rick Baker.
Cool.
But that just shows you how Hollywood took this film seriously. That we have to give a special award that we're not even giving out awards for, but this was so important, we got to give this film award out.
Yeah.
That Fox said, holy shit, look at the numbers.
They made a lot of money on that.
And then they said, we need a sequel. Now, for those of you who didn't pick up on the spoiler, we blew it up. Damn us all to hell.
Yes.
Earth had been destroyed, or as they said in Strange Brew, Earth had been like devastated by nuclear war. And, you know, Charlton Heston sees the broken Statue of Liberty on the beach, and he realizes that he's been on Earth all along. He's all alone because his two companions are gone, and he's the last survivor of this mission that got stuck in this time loop, and he's at this planet several hundred years in the future. Boom. End of story. But yet, we need a sequel.
Yeah. This is also at a time when sequels were not done for big pictures. The sequels that existed were for kiddie fare, science fiction, B-movies. And...
Or B-movies, like you said, like, you know, especially in the 50s, 40s and 50s, you'd have serials, movies that just kept coming out.
Right.
The Bulldog Drummond films would come out every couple months. The Boston Blackie films would come out every couple months. The Charlie Chan films. But those were series of films. They weren't a sequel, a direct sequel to a story.
Right. Yeah.
Now, you might want to slap me over the computer. I don't know. Some people do. Some people don't. Well, most people do. The sequel to The Planet of the Apes, the second movie in the series, is my least favorite in the series.
Yeah.
What about you?
It's not my least favorite. It's not my favorite either. But it's so batshit crazy that I like it a lot.
I like it.
The problem with it really is that the first half of the movie is just a remake of the first movie with James Franciscus instead of Charlton Heston. And Franciscus was great, but he was no Charlton Heston.
I like to call him Charlton Heston light.
Yeah. Everything about him was lighter.
Yeah.
he was a smaller person physically. He was, didn't have that gravitas that Heston had. But he looked good, and he did well with the role. But out of I don't know if it's out of necessity. It was out of necessity in the way that, that the script was written. You've got to get Taylor, I mean, I'm sorry, you've got to get Brent into the same, you know, Finding Nova and all that. And so to get there, you've got to go through all the same steps that the first movie went through. So I always find the first half a little bit boring, except for the scenes with Ursus. And, but also just kind of repetitive. It's we've seen this. There, but once they go underground, then it turns into a completely different movie that is nothing like the original film.
No, then it turns into an acid trip.
Yeah. Yeah. How many drugs were they all taking when they did this?
You said the secret word. If Groucho were here, you would win the prize. Because whereas in the first film, if you had to say there was a villain, it was Dr. Zaius.
Yeah.
But do you consider Dr. Zaius a villain or someone who's really trying to protect his own culture because he knows how dangerous humans are?
Yeah. If he was clearly the latter as opposed to an outright villain. He knew what Heston was. He knew everything, but he did not want to admit it. And I think it was just he was trying to protect his life, his culture.
But fast forward a couple of years and you get a big screen villain.
For sure.
With
Ursus. Ursus in that helmet.
Played by the great James Gregory.
Yes.
Which I always thought was funny because I still think of him primarily as character in Barney Miller.
Right.
That's him to me.
I remember vaguely when I made the discovery that was James Gregory. That, you know, I knew Ursus was played by James Gregory, but it was years after I'd seen the movie before I saw James Gregory and put, oh, this is the guy who played Ursus. And then I was how did
you realize one of the scariest on-screen villains of all time is, hey, Aban, Inspector Luger. Yeah. I don't mind it, Inspector Luger. But he is terrifying as Ursus.
Yes. Yeah, he is.
I mean, there's scenes in the first movie that are haunting and frightening, the hunt, where the apes are rounding up and hunting the humans, when he's being chased down. But Ursus brings an actual level of horror into the ape series. Do you think it was wasted as a character because so much of the second half of the film didn't involve him and it involved the underground mutants?
I think there were certainly a lot of lost opportunities. He was such a big character that I would have loved to have seen the movie centered around him. But you know, we got what we got, and it's hard to say what that would have been like. But I can imagine that it would have been a much cooler film if it had been more about Ursus and not the mutants.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it would have been such a great villain going after the good guy hunt movie instead of usually the other way around. It's a role reversal Dirty Harry movie, and it could have been great. Instead, we get underground mutants who worship radiation and the bomb.
Yeah.
And have a really cathedral built to the bomb. That somehow Charlton Heston fell into an invisible force field to fall into their world. Right. No explanation. No nothing.
Yep.
It's just there.
Yep.
Leading to what a great ending that Heston survives. We find out Taylor's alive. But now the guy who yelled at the people for blowing it up decides he's going to blow it up.
Yeah.
Now, do you think, and this is opinion time, some people have said yes, some people have said no, it's kind of up in the air. Do you think that was the studio's way of saying, let's just blow the whole fucking thing up so they don't come to us for another sequel.
I know that that was Heston's thinking. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do the sequel and turned it down originally. But they begged him. Arthur P. Jacobs begged him to do it. And his condition was that he dies at the end. I don't know whose idea it was for Taylor to blow everything up. But I do think it was deliberate. I've seen a lot of people think that he didn't mean to do that. He was just reaching. And no, it was deliberate.
Oh, yeah.
He ended. I don't know how people cannot see that was deliberate, but some people don't. But certainly that was Heston's. It was a way to ensure that there would be no more sequels and they wouldn't bother him anymore.
Well, little did they know that if you thought it was brilliant to be able to come up with a sequel to the first one, how do you come up with a sequel to a film where you literally blew up the entire planet? And specifically say, at the end of the movie, the planet's dead. How do you have a sequel? You get with, in my opinion, outside of the pure cinematic genius of the first film, my opinion is the best film in the series.
Yeah.
And that is the classic Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Bringing back Roddy McDowall, we forgot to mention that, you know, Roddy McDowall did not return.
Yeah, he was busy directing his own movie.
Yep, so the only Apes film he was not in. But he comes back, and then they do... we're going to do spoilers, folks. I'm going to assume you've all seen these movies, because if you haven't, there's something wrong with you for listening to this episode, not just for, you know...
Although that's true, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true, too. Especially they're all tuning in, where's Lauren? We miss Lauren. But Escape from the Planet of the Apes, in my humble opinion, was a brilliant idea to be able to create a sequel out of a destroyed planet. Yeah. And it really is a great film. Now, again, I make the difference between a great movie and a great film. A great movie you eat popcorn at and enjoy and cheer. A great film is something you remember.
Yeah.
And Escape from the Planet of the Apes is a great film, which had about one third of the budget of the first movie.
Right.
But we didn't need it, because this time there's only three apes, and one of them they kill off right away.
Yeah.
So, folks, for those who don't know, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, somehow, Roddy McDowall and Kim Hunter, Dr. Cornelius and Zira, along with their friend Milo as another scientist, somehow fixed Charlton Heston's original spaceship. And before the planet blew up, they escaped and ended up kind of in the same time warp. And I say kind of because this is one thing that I love. Whether it was intentional or not, I'm going to ask you. The timelines never match up for any of the Apes films.
No, they don't.
Now, some people could say, they just screwed up while they were writing. They were just throwing numbers at random. To me, I think it almost makes more logical sense that you can't predict these weird time tunnels and things. Nothing's going to be the same. It makes sense that nothing matches. Anyway, they come back and they land in 1970s America. Take it from there. What do you like most about Escape? We're going to go into Escape now. What's your favorite, your pros, cons of Escape, points that you like, points you didn't like, things you think they might have missed?
Well, I think Escape has one of the, just as the first Planet of the Apes had one of the best endings ever, I think Escape has one of the best openings ever for a film, because it starts with humans have discovered this spaceship has landed in the ocean. They drag it out. There are astronauts that are alive inside. They come out, and then they take off the helmets, and they discover they're apes. And everything about that is just amazing to me. The surprise, if you, you know, go into a movie called that and can be surprised. But the same kind of goosebumps that I get from the Statue of Liberty, I get every time I see them take their helmets off and they're apes. And you've got all the military men, you know, saluting and going like, what?
Yeah, because they're even wearing the U.S. uniforms.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the same ANSA uniforms that Taylor had on.
Which same I love. Yeah.
Yeah.
Specify that again. What? Who are they flying for?
ANSA.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I forgot what that was. American Nautological. I can't remember what it's in.
Basically, they couldn't use NASA, so they just reversed two letters.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Same logo, everything.
Right. It's great. Brilliant.
You know, nowadays NASA would absolutely sign on to let them use that for advertising.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so Cornelius, Zira, and Milo end up here, played by Salminio.
Salminio, yep.
So Salminio was tail end of his career. His best days were behind him. He wasn't the Hollywood big shot he had the potential to become. Why do you think they would actually spend the money on someone who was well-known enough to command a higher salary when they just kill him off right away?
That's a good question. I don't know. I've never really understood that. I assume that Jacobs wanted him in his movie, period.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I couldn't figure out as if did Sal have problems on the set and they all hated him and wanted to get rid of him, so they wrote him off?
It was my understanding that he did not like the makeup, that he signed on for it. But once they actually started doing the makeup, he didn't like it. He was claustrophobic. It bothered him. And they ended up killing him off sooner than they originally had planned. That's my understanding. I don't know if that's accurate or not. But
with the only bad effect in the entire movie.
The gorilla.
Oh,
the stupid looking gorilla that wasn't as good as the 50s gorillas.
No, that's the thing. The makeup for these films was so good and so believable. You know, do you remember the tagline for Superman? You'll believe a man could fly.
Right.
I, as a kid, believed apes could talk.
Yes. You know,
as a little kid, they made me believe that. And even as a little kid, I said, that's a dude in a big gorilla suit. The gorilla, it was so bad.
In a bad gorilla suit.
Yeah. It was Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn gorilla suit. I mean, it was just bad.
Yeah.
But that leads to the great reveal of Zira speaking, which has that same impact on everybody as when Taylor first spoke. You know, I love how they mirror it. I mean, because it really is just a mirror of the first film, just reversing the roles.
But it works that way, whereas Beneath was the first half of Beneath felt like just rehashing, remaking the first movie. Escape remakes the first movie, but flips it on its head by reversing the roles. And it does it brilliantly, like the reveal when Zira speaks. That's every bit as surprising and shocking as the first time Taylor speaks.
Although Taylor speaks out of anger. Zira speaks out of snarkiness.
Right. Which makes her lovable.
Yeah, and that's
and funny. It adds humor to the film.
Yeah. That's another great thing about that film. You only primarily, we're going to forget Salminio, he gets killed off by the guy in the gorilla suit. But you got Roddy McDowall and Kim Hunter reprising their roles and having to carry the whole movie as the ape population. And as great as Roddy McDowall is, Kim Hunter steals that movie.
Oh, yeah.
She is so fantastic in the role. In that movie in particular.
Yeah.
Even more so than the original two.
Oh, yeah.
That you really, I always say, it doesn't have to be a brilliant film, but a good movie or a good director or a good writer can make you go against your own better judgment. For instance, I'm a lifelong Yankees fan. First major league film, I'm cheering for the Indians over the Yankees at the end of that film. That should never happen in real life.
Right.
Kim Hunter is so good in that movie, you start hating mankind.
Oh, yeah.
In favor of her. And they're not doing anything horrible, the men. Well, one is, but again, it's the Dr. Zaius thing. He's, you know, protecting his people, his kind. Right.
Yeah.
But we get another big reveal in this one. They weren't painting themselves into no goddamn corner this time.
Right. No, they weren't.
Oh, Zira, you're pregnant.
Yeah.
Which led me to the question, was she pregnant before or after they came to Earth?
Good question. I've always assumed it was before.
I would have always assumed it was before, but why would she take a space travel that way? You know? But then again, I'm thinking it couldn't be after because they were being watched 24/7. Unless they were a little bit kinky voyeur, you know.
And only apes didn't exist then, so.
No, only apes didn't exist, so. Ilo's dead, honey. You know, now's the chance.
Yeah, but what it's the humor aspect of Escape that I think really makes it such a great film. And Kim Hunter's performance in particular. But the whole, you know, the shopping montage, mm-hmm. you have to love them. You begin to care so much for Zira and Cornelius. If you didn't already, you do at this point. Because they're just so lovable and likable and relatable. And you know, it just sets up for yet another bleak ending.
Well, yeah, that's right. You know, you get to see Kim Hunter get drunk, and it's so cute and bubbly. And they're
but
such
also
a
terrifying.
Yeah. Then there's such a
it
charming.
It's terrifying for her.
It, well, it does, yeah. But they're such a charming couple. And you see this love and this compassion. There's even that scene of social reflection, which always kind of bothered me because my other big passion in life is boxing, where Cornelius goes, is taken to the boxing match, and he's appalled by how barbaric it is, showing that humans aren't very evolved either, folks.
Right.
I was always insulted by that bit a little bit. So I'm like, fuck you, Larry Holmes, kick your ass. But...
But then there's the great courtroom scene where, again, the humor that works in where, you know, does the other ape speak? Only when she lets me.
Only when she lets me.
That's great.
And what's great about this film is it is funny, it's charming, it's endearing. You fall in love with these characters, and boom, they spin it on you 180.
Oh, yeah.
And the film goes dark and bleak for the second the last third of the film.
Yes.
Maybe a little more, I would say, but about a third. And it becomes darker than even the first movie.
It turns into a horror movie, basically. Not horror in terms of monster, well, kind of monsters, but not that kind of horror film. But the things that are happening to these characters, it's horrific. It's spinning out of control for them. And everything's going south.
And again, you have to wonder, you're being told to hate him for what he's doing, for wanting them dead and get rid of them. But at the same time, he's doing it to protect mankind because he knows what they are.
And kudos to Eric Braeden for that performance because while Hasline is unlikable, he completely sells the, I'm doing this to protect humanity. And so you can't hate him. You just hate what he's doing to the lovable apes that you care about.
Yeah, because it's now, if he was doing this to Ursus, we'd be like, yeah, do that.
Right.
Kill him.
Yeah, it's, exactly.
He's doing it to who we love.
Right.
And,
But course, his is the other really, the other performance is just really makes that movie.
The other great villain of the series.
Yeah.
So then you get, you know, Kim Hunter pregnant. She gives birth, has a little baby chimp, which is adorable because they actually use a real baby chimp in a couple of scenes. And it's absolutely adorable. But it becomes even darker now because now they're hunting the kid. They want to kill the baby.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really tugs at a lot of people when they realize oh, they're even going to kill the infant.
Yeah.
It gets you.
In fact, that's Hasline's goal. It's not to kill Zeer and Cornelius. It's to kill the baby.
Yeah. Yeah,
because they're going to scare live. Them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
But the great thing about that is it leads to the introduction of a character that only has a couple scenes in this movie, has a bigger role in the next movie, but he is such a scene-eating bastard that everything he's in, he could steal any show, and that's the great Ricardo Montalban.
Yes, Armando.
And, you know, he's so good as Armando and so caring and compassionate. I never saw him give a performance that wasn't balls to the wall.
Oh, yeah. No, he's always.
But have you ever seen him play a character as calm and caring? And even Mr. Rourke was never as soothing as Armando was.
Yeah, no. Armando was special.
Yeah, he was a very loving man. But then, you folks think those first two movies had bad endings? You know, with, well, the Earth blown up is pretty bad. Okay, so those endings are bad. But this one...
Oh, this one hits you where it hurts.
Yeah. Not only does she get shot, he gets pushed off. You watch him come up and shoot the baby!
Yeah.
But guess what?
Surprise.
Yeah, surprise! We're not painted into a corner here. Armando switched the babies, which is also the second worst effect in any Special of the Apes film ever.
Mama, mama.
Mama, mama. The baby chip saying mama.
Yeah. But it was Zira who switched them, not Armando.
Yes.
She goes to visit Heloise. He arranges it. He sets things up. But Zira goes to see Heloise and swaps the babies at that point.
And he protects.
And he protects. Armando knows what happened, but he didn't set it up or didn't do it.
Which leads to the next film in the series. And as bleak and as dark as all the films have really been so far, they've all been rated G.
Yes.
A movie where a baby gets shot point blank multiple times gets rated G. This next film gets a PG. How fucking bad can it be?
Pretty dark.
Conquest.
Yes.
Is a dystopian future movie. Yep. It's unlike any other of the Apes films.
Yeah.
It almost goes into a totally different sci-fi genre of the dystopian future.
Yeah, it does.
So I'm going to let you go with this. Give a brief description, overview of the film, and your takeaways, your loves, hates about this one. Likes, loves, hates, things that miss, things that hit about this one.
Well, Conquest tells the story of the surviving baby, the son of Zira and Cornelius, 20 years in the future. When cats and dogs have been wiped out by a virus that was brought back to Earth from astronauts, and humans wanting their pets turned to apes, which were not affected by the virus. And then over time, they discovered that the apes could do more than their dogs and cats could. And long story short, they created basically a slave population of trained apes. And into this awful society comes Milo, who later changes his name to Caesar. But he's been hidden from all this, protected from all this by Armando. And so the film opens with his first visit to the city and his first exposure to what life is like on this new Planet of the Apes, Planet of the Apes pets. And he's quite horrified by what he sees, because they are basically slaves, told to do chores for their masters and punished when they don't. And yeah, it's pretty shocking for young Milo.
Yeah, and they also show that not only did we replace our pets with these primates that are, you know, pretty damn close to us on an evolutionary scale.
Yeah.
But our society has stopped being an American society, and it's really become almost a fascist state.
Yes. Yeah, lots of Nazi-like imagery.
Yes.
With the black boots and the black uniforms, and which was unsettling to see back when it came out and still is. Because it's not a fun place to live, whether you're human or an ape.
No. And then Armando doesn't live.
Yep.
They kill him. Well, he kills himself, but.
Yeah.
Now, Roddy McDowall comes back to play his own son, which is pretty damn cool.
Right. Yes. And he does it. He plays a different character.
Very.
He's not Cornelius. And John Chan, the makeup, I don't know if it, how much Chambers had at that point. It might have been somebody else. But the tweaks to the makeup were great because he looked, you know, he resembled Cornelius, but he didn't look like Cornelius.
Yeah,
because he wasn't Cornelius.
There was little details in the makeup that was really amazing that I don't think a lot of people pick up on at first. But the hair around the face where the beard would be is much different on the older apes than the younger apes.
Yes.
Just little details like that you wouldn't even be thinking about. The length of the back of the hair in the gorillas was different. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's really impressive that he gives all these characters, which a lot of people complain today is a very generic, basic makeup, yet they're all distinct. They all right. have their own person. Now, part of that's the actor has to emote through it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just put great makeup on someone and say, there you go. That's what CGI is for. You know, the great makeups throughout history, it's the actor in them that sells it.
Oh, yeah.
And Roddy McDowall is a perfect example of that, because you believe that this character is not Roddy McDowall Cornelius.
Yes.
So, being a little bit smarter than the average ape, he does not like what he sees. And he's a rebellious one.
Yeah.
He's a revolutionary. And he starts leading an insurrection. So my question to you, do you consider him a hero, or do you consider him righteous, or do you consider him a villain?
Yeah, well, that's one of the great things about that movie is he's a little bit of both. Because of the goodwill from that escape generated, we want to see him as the hero. But at the same time, you know, he's setting out to destroy humanity.
Yeah, he doesn't just lead a revolt; he leads a violent insurrection.
Yes, all those scenes of them, you know, all the apes bringing him the various weapons. It's chilling. And Caesar at this point, so he was purchased at auction by the governor, and he got to choose his own name, and he chose Caesar, which should have been some great foreshadowing for the governor to pay attention to, but he didn't. Although they mentioned it, the king, but
I love the fact that in every film, Charlton Heston stuck in this horrific land he doesn't belong in, but he actually finds a couple of apes that are caring and helpful. It's exact same thing in the sequel, because as we all know, it was basically the first half was a remake.
Right.
Third film. Cornelius and Zira are adored by the public, and the two doctors do everything they can to protect them, even when they know they're about to be killed. Now you get to this film, And you can understand Caesar flipping his shit when Armando, the only person he's ever really loved as a parent in his life, is yes. taken from him. But then when he decides to destroy humanity, even though there are people who sympathize with him and do care about him. So, but he doesn't seem to let that conflict with his anger.
No.
He doesn't seem to give a shit.
No, he doesn't.
Which to me, he always said Caesar was more of a villain.
Yeah. Oh, he definitely is. That there's that wonderful, I think, wonderful scene with Mr. McDonald when he's supposed to be looking for him. Everybody's looking for Caesar, and he's with McDonald. And McDonald says, you know, I wish you could understand. And he speaks to him for the first time. And he shows that he gets it. He understands McDonald. He understands his history, his feelings. But it's too late. He doesn't care.
No.
Because they killed Armando. And the fact that McDonald didn't have anything to do with that is irrelevant. Because the apes are being treated as slaves, and he's there to free them.
At whatever cost.
At whatever cost.
And not only at whatever cost, but with the most destruction as he possibly could muster.
Yeah.
Yeah, he becomes a single-minded fascist.
Yeah.
Horrible to say, since he's supposed to be our protagonist and our hero. So, as we had mentioned...
But that's the thing, though, that the fascist state is so awful that he's still not a horrible villain because he's not slaughtering people out playing with rabbits in the field.
No.
That's true. But, when it's going up against the jackbooted thugs, and so you're still kind of rooting for him.
You are. It's like we said before, it's the first of the films that gets a PG rating. And I think by a lot of standards, it could have easily gotten an R rating.
Oh, yeah.
For the themes and for the violence and for the actual scene of the rebellion, when the revolt finally happens, it's terrifying. And it's shot brilliantly.
And yes.
As a 50-year-old adult, I still find it scary to watch.
Oh, yeah. And yet the silence of all the apes coming down the walkway in silence. And yeah, it's scary.
And this is filmed on, I think, about a quarter of the budget of the first movie.
Yep. Yeah, the budget dropped with each movie.
And it looks so good.
Yeah.
Now, here's my one complaint again, they knew they couldn't box themselves into a corner. Even though I'm pretty sure they wanted that to be the last. I think everybody involved pretty much wanted that to be the last film.
Yeah, probably.
And it ends with Caesar giving this really horrific speech about the planet, the rise of the Planet of the Apes. Yep. But the studio, for the first time, chickens out on their ending.
Yes, they do.
They didn't chicken out on the world is destroyed, you bastard, you maniacs. They didn't chicken out on the earth blowing up. They didn't chicken out on them shooting a baby multiple times. I'm going to point that out again. Point blank, he shoots the baby. That's yes. fine. But finally, even though they got a bigger rating, they chicken out on the ending. And tell our audience what they did.
Well, they had already shot the film. Before they decided to change the ending to a feel-good ending, at least as feel-good as you could do. And so in order to make it work, they had to zoom in on the footage of Caesar talking. And it doesn't fit anymore. You've got these words of pacifism coming out of scenes that were shot that were very violent and dark. And the whole thing is just kind of odd because you've got these odd zoomed in close-ups of Caesar's eyes.
Which are menacing.
Which are menacing, and they don't match the words that are coming out. about, you know, now we're going to lay down our weapons. And it's just,
yeah,
it doesn't work. And the uncut version, which is available on Blu-ray, is so much better, in my opinion.
It, what's amazing is that it really does go from a, I'm going to revolt, I'm going to take over, I'm going to dominate and destroy you badasses, to hippy-dippy, we're going to sing Kumbaya at the end bullshit.
Right.
Why of all the times to wuss out in an ending?
Yeah.
That one.
I don't know.
But I think we do know. I just don't think we want to acknowledge that the studio was like, we're going to try to milk this cow one more time.
Right. Sure. That
and if
wise.
We end this film with him being a bloodthirsty bastard, no one's going to want to see the next one.
Right. Which is true.
And there are reports. Now, you could tell me if this is true or not. Again, you never know what's Hollywood legend and what's fact. That at test screenings, before they changed the ending, parents were running out of the theater with their children, like, in terror.
I don't doubt that, because, as you pointed out, the first movies were all rated G, and people had come to think of them as, despite the bleak endings and the violence and everything else, I think people still were shocked at just how much darker Conquest was, and it was upsetting.
It was.
Especially coming after the lighthearted bits of Escape.
The lighthearted ending, like him shooting the baby.
Right, well, maybe not that part, but the rest of it.
But that leads us into the last and final film, your introduction.
Well.
And the lowest budget by far of all the ape films.
Yep.
Now, I have some issues with this film. I love all the films. Like I said, it's my favorite science fiction film franchise. I like the fact that they... Oh, by the way, folks, the next one picks up several years in the future. Caesar is now running the planet. He's pretty much emperor. And ape society is starting to come together.
Yeah.
Do you like the direction they took Caesar in at that point?
Well, it fits with the Kumbaya ending that they grafted on to a Conquest. So from that aspect, I don't have a problem with the direction of the film. But it's just so incredibly low budget that it's hard to pull anything off and have it work, including this society of human and apes living together. Where would the film have gone otherwise? I don't know. I'm never good at trying to imagine stuff like that. But it is hard to reconcile what we saw in Conquest with what's going on in battle.
And there are very bleak moments, obviously, like all the ape films.
Yeah.
Caesar watches his son be killed. Caesar flips his shit like he did in Conquest before the Kumbaya part. The humans that want to go to war with the apes, and, you know, the apes and humans that work together, featuring Paul Williams. I always love to say I'm a Paul Williams fan. I love Paul Williams.
Oh yeah.
I think he was a great actor. I think he was hilarious. I think he's one of the greatest songwriters in American history. I've been trying to get him to come on the show forever, Paul. You should return my calls, Paul. We've had Nobel Prize winners on the show, Paul. You're not too big for it. Get it big, because he's real short. But I think that was the first movie Paul Williams was in too, wasn't it? Or one of them.
One of them, sure.
But something is lacking in this film. And what I think it is that even though the budgets were getting lower and lower in the films, this film doesn't have the heart that all the other films seem to have.
Right.
No character in that film do you identify with and latch on to? Or is that just me?
No, I think you're right. I think they're counting on people liking Caesar and wanting to see him succeed to whatever degree. But they don't really do anything with Caesar to make you continue to like him or want to like him more or anything, despite his attempts at wanting to live together with the humans and stuff. I lost where I was going with that, but
that's about all you can go with it.
Yeah. There's just not a whole lot there.
Because the villains aren't really villainous other than the fact that
that's what I was going to say. They came back with it. You've got a new villain. You've got Aldo, but as great as Claude Akins is, he was just another gorilla with a bad attitude.
Yeah, and he was a gorilla who didn't like the weakness of a wimpy Caesar.
Yeah.
You know, even your human villains, I mean, they're not really villains. It's more like, yeah, this is what would happen. You can't really side with it, and we don't know all their politics. It's a fun film to watch, especially as a kid. As a kid, I liked it a lot more. It's the one film that, as an adult, I like less than I did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because all the other films I actually like more than I did when I was a kid.
Yeah, sure. I get that.
It's still a fun romp. It's still a great way to end a series. It's still, you know, if I'm watching an Apes marathon, of course I'm going to watch it. But I got to bring up the fucking ambiguous ending.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. They spent for a movie that had pretty much no budget, because like I said, every film, the budget went lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. And by the time they got to Battle, I think they were making it for just over $1 million.
Yeah.
Which is nothing. I mean, more than $1 million was on the makeup budget in the first film.
Right.
So, you know, half the apes are wearing rubber masks that I think were probably made by the Don Post studio. Nothing against those. I always wanted when I was a kid. I never got one. Thanks, Mom. I still wanted that Cornelius mask I never got. But it was just cheap looking. You can't blame the director. He did a great job with what he had. The final scene with the battle looks like a real battle. And then you realize he actually had a bus and two cars.
Right.
And yet he was able to shoot it, so it looked like a whole army invasion. It was a great job.
Yeah, he did. He did a great job with what he had.
But yet they spend, which had to be about a third of their budget, on one of the biggest names in Hollywood history to appear in two scenes in orangutan makeup.
Right.
What the fuck are they thinking?
Yeah. And not only that, but of all of the actors in the ape makeups, he was the least convincing.
Yes.
He does not look like a talking ape. He looks like something.
John Huston.
John Huston. With something on his face.
Now, I know that they had initially wanted Orson Welles for that role.
Yeah.
And I wonder how that would have been. I think Orson Welles' voice coming out of an ape would have been really intense.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think by that time, Orson Welles was already struggling with the weight. Which there could be fat apes. Why not? You know, I'm a fat guy. I would have appreciated a fat ape.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. But John Huston just comes off like John Huston delivering a monologue, which he can barely deliver through the makeup.
Yeah. Old John Huston delivering a monologue he can barely deliver.
And then it goes to a statue of the ape who sheds a tear at the end. And people have been arguing since the movie came out, is it a tear because he knows what's to happen? Is it a tear because he's happy the apes and the humans are getting along? Is it a tear because, holy shit, we got to pay the catering bill and there's no budget left? what's your take? I mean, seriously, and I think they left it ambiguous on purpose. I think that it's one of those examples where the filmmakers wanted the audience to take away with it what they wanted. Instead of being spoon-fed. So many people want to spoon-feed everything into a film. I think they wanted it. William Friedkin famously said of The Exorcist that, you know, him and William Peter Blatty fought over the ending.
Right.
Because there were two scenes that Friedkin cut from the ending of the film. Yeah. One where the two priests are talking before the final bit of the exorcism, and then one at the end where the priest and the cop are talking, and it ties it all together. And it explains, it really explains what was in the novel.
Yeah.
And Friedkin said, well, fuck that. I didn't want that too. I want people to take out of that film whatever they brought in with them.
Yeah.
Which is why some people left that film seeing it as a happy ending as it was. Other people left the film saying, what a terrible ending. The devil won. The priests are dead.
Yeah.
You have to take it with, you know. And I think that tier is the same way. They wanted the audience to take their own thing from it. But what was your take? What did you take away? Was it a tear of joy or a tear of sadness?
I always took it as a tear of sadness. It comes after the hair pulling incident.
Yes, that's and my thing.
Showing that humans and apes are still picking at each other.
They
always got the impression they're never going to change. It's going to happen all over again.
No, and a lot of people, I do too. I see it exactly that way. Now, a lot of sociologists say that everything was a metaphor, that humans were represented white people and apes represented black people, even though in all the movies there were black and white humans.
Right.
But they were using ape and human as social class, as sociological. I think maybe somewhat in the first film. I don't think it was like that throughout the rest of the series.
I agree.
I think maybe a little bit in the first film. But that was more class distinction than race distinction. Because even in the first film, the apes never considered each other equals.
I always took that as people have long debated, you know, what did the author really mean? Did he do this intentionally? And knowing some authors, I know that that's sometimes it is intentional, but not always.
No.
And I think the first movie was done mostly as talking about class. And it just happened to coincide with the Watts riots and everything else so that it became about race. People could see it and say, oh, that's about race. But I think it was originally more about class. And because, as you said, there were apes, the orangutans, and the gorillas, and the chimpanzees, and they don't mix together.
And like every sociologist says, even Offset, it was the same way. You know, they always say it was so shocking that when they'd go to break, you could see pictures of the set. All the gorillas were at one table, where the chimpanzees were at another table, where the orangutans were at another table, and it's just instinctively you go to your own group.
Right.
Well, that's not shocking. Any sociologist in the world would have told you that would happen.
Yeah.
You remember the movie The Warriors? The great. I was at a screening of The Warriors where a couple people who were in the Rifts were at the screening because they were actually from the area I live in, and they were there for the presentation. And they were telling me the same thing, that, you know, the day that all the gangs were there from all the different cities, it was the same thing.
Yeah.
Even though I had friends that were actors in other gangs, we didn't mix with them. Offset. You know, when you went to break, it's sociological. It just happens. And I think the movie wanted to show that in the first film. I don't think it was such a big deal until the last film. There was kind of a power struggle.
Yeah.
Anyway, movies are done. They finished the films. But that's not enough, because all of a sudden CBS has got the rights on TV, and why don't you tell them what happens?
The ratings went through the roof when they showed those films. And being greedy people, Hollywood said, Fox said, how can we benefit from this? And Fox and CBS got together and decided a TV series is the way to go.
Not only a TV series. Marketing, marketing, marketing.
Yes, I was going to get into that too.
Yeah.
People think Star Wars created the whole marketing thing with the toys and stuff, Planet of the Apes did it years before. Not many years, 3 years before. But with the launch of the TV series, they went bananas.
Ha, ha, ha.
Uh-huh. With marketing and licensing everything, anything. It didn't have to have anything to do with Planet of the Apes. They'd still sell the name and let a company slap it on whatever product so that you've got Planet of the Apes walkie-talkies.
Yeah, there was something like, there was so many companies that each were able to license out so many products, though. It was ridiculous. But yeah, you had the standards with the lunch boxes, the coloring books, the action figures, the toys, the games, the Don Post Studio Cornelius mask that I never got. Thanks, Mom.
trash cans.
The trash cans. I think I had an Apes trash can, and I had a couple of the action figures. But then Star Wars hit, and everything in the world changed. But here comes the TV show, which, and I could be wrong on this. I checked that it was something like $250,000 per episode.
That's what my understanding, yeah.
Which today sounds like nothing when every cast member of Friends was getting $1 million per episode for that hunk of shit that you couldn't pay me to watch. But, you know, in 1974, $250,000 was, you could make full-length movies for $250,000.
Yeah.
And they were doing that for every episode.
Yeah.
Now, what I love about it is, A, Roddy McDowell comes back, but he's no longer any of the characters he was before, because it's in a completely different timeline.
Yes.
And then you got Ron Harper, who, great television actors, you know, everyone saw him before, and James Naughton, who was relatively newcomer. I mean, he was a fresh face. Rumor has it, it was down to James Naughton and Mark Singer for the role.
Right. Yeah.
Naughton beat him out, but the Beastmaster got his own a few years later, and he got an episode of the series. So,
right.
I think Harper and Naughton were fantastic in this show. I think they were probably, with the exception of Heston in the first one, the most relatable humans in any Apes franchise.
Yeah.
I thought the series was incredibly well done. I thought introducing the villain of Urko, very much like Ursus, with as powerful an actor.
Yes. Mark Leonard.
Yep. The great Mark Leonard, who had previously done Star Trek as Sarek, gives as great a performance as Urko, as Ursus was. And the fact that each individual show was a separate adventure, but was one continuous running storyline of them being chased by Urko, who wants to kill them, and Zaius, who wants them detained, while they're trying to figure out a way to get back home.
Yep.
It didn't last.
No, it didn't. Too much. It became too much of the same story, because it boiled down to, for whatever reason, whoever was making decisions about it, it became, you know, The Fugitive. And every week they were in a new village, still being chased by Urko. And it just got old fast, I think, especially when the competition that it was up against when it was airing.
Yeah, the other network pretty much put the nail in that coffin, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. It never could win those rating slots. And that's something that people now, younger people, have no concept of those days when there were three networks. You watched one of those three networks. And there was no videotape.
No DVR.
No DVR. If you missed it, you missed it. So you had to choose what you were going to watch. Was it going to be Chico and the Man, or was it going to be Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, Planet of the Apes for me. But
yeah.
You had to schedule your schedule around your shows.
You had to be home on Friday nights, yes.
Yeah, because if you missed an episode of your favorite show, you weren't getting to see it again till, well, at the end of the season. Some series would replay the series. Other series wouldn't. You would have to hope it eventually went into syndication, or you'd never see that episode again.
But even syndication wasn't the thing that it is now back then. You had no idea if it was ever going to be seen again or not.
And an audience.
I was just saying, which they cleverly did by editing the episodes together to create the 5 movies.
Yeah. Well, like Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of the Planet of the Apes. Yeah, that's how I pretty much became ape obsessed. The other problem was, it was a smart show. It was a clever show. It was a very well acted and very well produced show.
Yeah.
But I don't think adults were watching it by that time. I think adults by that time thought, oh, the apes are kiddie films.
Right.
Saturday morning kiddie films. As bleak as they were, they seemed to forget that just 8 years ago, this was groundbreaking. It was not a children's film. But somehow, it got into people's heads that it was a kid's product.
Well, I suspect all the merchandising was the main reason for that.
Which is the opposite of today.
Right.
It's only adults that buy merchandise now. Right.
By the time this series started, you had all of that merchandise. And so, sure, adults are going to look at it and say, it's kids' stuff. My kids want the action figures. My kids want the trash can. Yeah, why should I watch that? So you're right. Adults weren't watching.
But do kids really want the trash can?
I did when I was an adult.
Okay.
I have them. I did not want those. That was not my priority when I was a kid, but
not
it was when I was an adult.
Then we go on to the last of the media of the original run of our beloved Planet of the Apes. And that was the animated series, which suffered a very similar fate to the TV show.
Yeah.
Just 13 episodes, one continuous storyline that they didn't get to finish because it got canceled before they did. Like the TV series.
Yeah.
Now it was a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. People forget that Hanna-Barbera did everything at that point. It was, looking back at it now, if you watch it, it comes across as a low budget, almost kind of cheesily done cartoon. But for the time, it was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But I have one main problem with that cartoon series. And it's one really big one is a timeline problem with Planet of the Apes, and the other one is
the screeching.
Remember who the villain was?
No.
Urko.
Oh, right.
It was Urko again, which shouldn't have been Urko because it was a completely different timeline. But we'll let that slide.
Voiced by Fred Flintstone.
That's my problem. Henry Corden was the voice of Urko. Now, not the original Fred Flintstone, Alan Reed, but when Alan died, Henry took over and was Fred Flintstone. And he doesn't use a different voice for Urko that he did for Fred Flintstone. So I keep wanting to hear Yabba Dabba Dirty Humans.
Yeah.
If you make the mistake of watching those and not paying attention, like you're typing on your computer, doing something else while that's on in the background, you hear Fred Flintstone talking about killing people.
Right.
It can really mess you up.
Yes.
The cartoon was, as you said, closer to the novel, with the apes having airplanes and helicopters and jeeps and cars. It had some really bad moments, like they would have pop songs that would just replace the word ape with the something, cheesy.
It's awful.
But it was pretty much the same plot as Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Pretty much the same plot. The underground people were like the mutants. The astronauts were trying to get, except they all survived in this one because you can't kill the other astronauts in the cartoon for Saturday mornings.
Right.
Oh, my cat's going weird. Anyway, cat being weird, go figure. So then it's over. I mean, that's it. It's a monster hit starting in 68. But by 78, it's gone.
Yeah.
Even the merchandising, the marketing. Was it that Star Wars killed it or that Fox just let it go, stopped giving a shit?
Yes. I think it was both. I think Fox, especially after Jacobs died, I think Fox just lost interest in it. There were diminishing returns for every movie, but of course, partially because they cut the budget for every movie. It was kind of self-fulfilling prophecy there. But I think by the end, by the time Battle limped across the finish line, I think the studio just didn't really care anymore.
And it's funny to look at saying it had such a short run. But at the time, a 10-year run for something is not short.
Especially as we mentioned earlier, at a time when movies did not have sequels like that in general.
It's not like we're looking at it through today's eyes that, you know, Star Wars is still going after 77 because Disney buys it and keeps, or Marvel keeps pumping out a movie every 3 months.
Right.
Oh, God, they're so annoying. Do you remember when they were good?
Yes.
I do. But Apes had a 10-year run, and it was a cultural phenomenon. And anybody who was born or raised in and around that time remembers it fondly.
Yeah.
But yet, anybody that was born mid-80s and after, it's like apes never existed in their universe.
Right.
It stopped being played. Well, TV stopped playing movies on weekends, that kind of part of it.
Yeah.
But they didn't even take advantage of the video boom. They could have marketed the hell out of it for the video boom and made it a big deal again. Who dropped the ball on the franchise, or was it just tied up in legal things?
I don't know. It's a good question. But again, I think not having Jacobs there to make it, you know, to keep pushing and keep doing stuff, I think it was just there was no advocate for it.
And, of course, we say that it was gone. It died. It disappeared. It didn't. There were comic books. There were books. There were novelizations. There were fanzines. Fandom never left. It was just mainstream.
Yes.
Populace that left us.
Yeah.
I don't even think we need to get into the Tim Burton
Please don't.
Movie.
That doesn't exist in my world.
But I just briefly want to hit on the new films. Yep. The rebooting of it and reimagining, I guess you could say. I mean, overall, I'm impressed by the budget and the effects. Woohoo. And I thought the first one was really well done. But is it just me or are we old farts and it's not memorable?
Not memorable. It's not. It doesn't have the same. I like them. They're not Planet of the Apes. But what they are, I like them okay. But they're not memorable. There's no moment of the hunt when you see a gorilla on horseback for the first time. There's nothing like that in any of the films. And some of that is probably due to the fact that they're trying to make blockbusters, pull in as much money as they can. They use the same tricks that all the other big blockbusters do. And so there's kind of a sameness to them, even though they're featuring apes.
I lied. I'm going to have to go to the Tim Burton thing just for one comment. I was a Tim Burton fan pretty much up until that film.
Yeah.
And it's not that that film killed it for me, his career for me. It's that and every film he did after that.
Yes.
He really got, I don't know if you want to say lazy or maybe full of himself or started believing he was part of the Hollywood system when he was an outsider.
Well, if I can figure out how to do this briefly. I run the website for an author named Robert McCammon. A novel he did in 1990 called Mine is something that Frank Darabont tried to make a film out of for several years. So I got to know Frank during that time. And this was around the same time that Planet of the Apes was being pushed around. And Frank told me that they came to him. They wanted him to direct it. And he did not like their script. He said the script was awful. But they were committed. They wanted this movie out in the summer of 2001. And Frank said, you know, you let me rewrite this and I'll do it. No, no, no. It has to be out here. So they were shopping different directors. And they got to Tim Burton. And for whatever reason, Tim Burton said yes. And that's the biggest problem with it. It is not a Tim Burton film.
No.
It's a film Tim Burton directed for Fox to meet a deadline that they set. And it shows.
I remember when it came out, me and a couple friends went to see it because, A, I was the biggest Planet of the Apes nerd there was. My friends liked Planet of the Apes, but they weren't apes nerds like I was. But we were all Tim Burton fans. We were all movie fans.
Yeah.
And the movie ended, and the one guy said, oh, that was amazing. Because that's what he thought he was supposed to say, I think.
Right. Yeah.
It's Tim Burton. We must praise him. It was amazing. Right. My other friend just looked at me and said, what did you think? And my only reaction was, I just watched that movie and I couldn't name one character.
Yeah.
I couldn't give you the name of one character in the movie that I just watched.
Yeah.
That's what was lacking in that film. There was no substance, no heart, nothing.
No. Just a series of scenes that were first way too jokey, with things like Charlton Heston as an ape who won't give up his gun.
Yeah.
Paul Giamatti's "Can't we all just get along?" stuff in those cracks. But it was like, it wasn't really a story with characters you cared about. It was a series of scenes.
And look what we can do with the effects.
Yeah. Now, and Rick Baker did a fine job with the makeups. They were rushed. He didn't have a whole lot of time to do that because they had to meet that deadline. So I don't think the makeups were as great as they could have been.
No. And I don't think the makeups were as great as the original.
No, I don't either.
When people bash, they're rubbery and they just look silly and amateurish. I'm like, made me believe.
Yeah.
And
they still do.
Yeah.
But for those original movies, for me, it's the whole aesthetic that just, I don't know, I saw it at the right time or something, but the clothes that they all wore, Zaius was rocking all those different variants of his outfit, the different jackets and coats. And
I would love one of those.
Yeah. I just think that that's all, it's just nothing that the films have, new films have nothing like that. Nothing that makes you embrace it and say, this is awesome.
Well, we are really running out of time because I'm going way over time with this. Because as you can tell, I'm an apes nerd. I love this stuff. But you're not getting away too easy. With first-time guests, I like to play a round of questions we call rapid fire. Some of the questions may have to do with the topic. Some of them don't. It doesn't matter. You just have to give an answer. There are no wrong answers unless you get them wrong and I tell you you're wrong.
Okay.
All right. Are you ready to play?
Sure. I guess.
First question. Pluto, planet or no planet?
Planet.
Good answer. Good answer. Question two. Coffee, tea, or milk?
Well, it'd have to be milk by default because I don't like coffee or tea.
Okay, well, there you go.
Not a huge milk drinker, but.
All right. We establish you're an Alice Cooper and a Kiss fan, so you like rock music.
Yep.
Favorite band, the color in their name. Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, Blue Oyster Cult.
Well, of those three, it would be Blue Oyster Cult.
Oh, you wanted to give another one, huh? Simply Red, right?
No, but the one that first came to mind actually for me was Blue Coop, which is a band most people have never heard of, but it's Dennis Dunaway from the original Alice Cooper group and Albert and Joe Bouchard from Blue Oyster Cult.
From Blue Oyster Cult, so you're combining them. Yeah.
So you're combining the two into Blue Coop. So that was what actually came to mind first, but most people have never heard of them.
Nah, you were going to say Whitesnake, admit it.
No, I wasn't. Nor son Great White.
Son of a night.
Next question. Original five favorite Apes movie.
I waffle between the first one and Conquest. As much as I love Escape, the first one, I guess I'd have to go with the first one just because of everything that it is.
If it's not Apes, favorite science fiction franchise?
Babylon 5, which isn't even a movie, but...
That's a shocking answer.
I love Babylon 5.
I've just never gotten that answer before. What about Alien? Do you consider that science fiction or horror?
Yes. I think the first film was horror.
Yes.
The second film was action. And the rest don't really count. So I would not call it science fiction.
All right. Favorite Roddy McDowall ape character?
That one's tough, but I'm going to have to go with Galen just because he's
from
so
the TV
darn
series.
Happy. Yeah.
Wow. Went TV series. I like it. I like Galen too. Do you like the Galen bumpers that they made for the, when they were on CBS?
Yeah, they were fun. Yeah.
They're fun. Yeah. They're kind of hard to find good quality of them, but
I've got what are probably the best quality and they're still shitty, but, years ago I put out, long before YouTube existed or anything, I collected from fans around the world the best sources I could of stuff like the extended battle and those bumpers and other things like that. But even what I have was the best I could find from different people, and it's still not very good. But they're fun. Cool to see them again.
Couple more questions. This one's the toughest one. This is a tough one. You might want to put your thinking cap on for this one. Whatever the topic, would you agree to come back on this show?
I would be happy to. Yeah. I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, see, we could talk for hours and hours and hours, so I would love that. Lauren would probably tell us both to shut up that we're nerds and Doctor Who is better than all of this stuff, so we'd have to let it go. Last question. What's the best place to go on the internet to see Planet of the Apes stuff?
Well, there's only one answer for that, and that's Hunter's Planet of the Apes archive.
That's right.
Which is pota.goatly.com.
Yep. Oh, I'm sorry. I talked over you. Give the details. Tell everybody what they can find.
pota.goatly.com, Planet of the Apes. You can find there the world's largest collection of apes ephemera. Everything is there from all over the world. And before I go any farther, the credit for all that stuff does not go to me. It goes to apes fans around the world who have been generous with sharing their collections. From Mark Talbot Butler's thousands of high-res stills and lobby cards. There are comic books. All the comic books can be found there, scanned in high res. All of the scripts can be found there. Photos of most of the merchandise that's been created. The old Apes newspaper promos that were done can all be found there. There are fan-created things. There are other websites that died and went away, but I managed to resurrect them as subsites of the site. There is a ton of stuff there, and I've done the curating and the creating of everything, but the real credit goes to all of the fans around the world who've generously shared their time and collections with everything. And I also wanted to say about that, it seems seems to me in hindsight really egotistical that it's called Hunter's Planet of the Apes Archive. But there's a story behind that. It started in 2003, and it started with just some friends of mine and I who wanted to share a few files among ourselves. And I had a website, so I created this place to put these things, and everybody started calling it Hunter's Archive. And before I knew it, everybody started calling it Hunter's Archive, and then it became the name. So I always feel a little silly that that's the name, but that's how people knew it, and it didn't make sense to try to change it after that. But it's been a lot of fun for 21 years almost that we've been running that site. And
it's an amazing site. Like I said, it's one of the bookmark sites on my computer. I absolutely love this site. And this is the first time we've gotten a chance to speak, but I feel like I've known you for close to 20 years just through the website. And
thank you.
I am so glad you could come on. Hunter Goatley, no R in there, folks. Hunter Goatley, you are welcome back on the show anytime, my friend.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I've had fun. And if you want to talk Alice next time, I'd be up for that.
Oh, I'm definitely up for that. But for now, it's about time to sign off. Since Lauren from Swansea is not here, it's just me flying solo, Brian in Buffalo, saying good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Oh, it's a weird one.